errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University. Now, here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today, we'll be joined by AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon and DC Labor Film Fest Director Chris Garlock. But first, hear Jason Fornicola's interview with AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker.
We've been joined by Arlene Holt-Baker, the Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Now, the AFL and many unions and organizations around the country have recently participated in what was the One Nation March at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about the march and what the purpose was.
Well, Jason, tens of thousands of people from, quite frankly, around the nation came to the Lincoln Memorial on October the 2nd to talk about issues that are so important to everyone in our nation. Jobs, because there is a need for job creation. We know this with 15 million workers unemployed, and need for boldness in a legislative agenda that can put America back to work and put America back to work with good jobs for the long term. People also gathered to talk about the issues of justice, certainly for those who were there talking about workers and justice. People and workers talked about workers needing to have the ability to organize, therefore saying that they needed legislation and labor law reform that would give them the right to organize in a collective manner if they chose to do so. Transportation security officers were there, as you very well know, with AFGE organizing those workers. They were there to talk about the need to work collectively and to have a union so that they could have a voice at work, so that they could ensure that they had input in making sure that those who travel in our country are secure. And then we had those who gathered, from students to teachers and others who are concerned about education in this country, with a focus on the need to ensure that every child in our country has access to quality public education, Jason. But people left with a determination that this upcoming election is so very, very critical. And if we are able to go forward in this country, it's going to be dependent on activism from those who came. So they left charged up and ready to vote on November the 2nd and to keep on fighting on November the 3rd to move the country forward so that we can ensure that we have elected our officials who are going to be bold in their policies to put us back to work. We will have elected officials who will be bold in protecting the rights of not just workers, but in fact, the human rights of all people in this country, no matter their sexual orientation, their race, or gender. And then certainly education, the boldness there that we need is to ensure that there are resources to continue to have a quality public education system.
Talk for a minute, if you can, about the sacrifice that people make here at home for things like justice, education, public education, workers' rights, those sorts of things.
Well, when you think about education, so many people make major sacrifices to make sure that their children can go to school, continue on from K through 12 and to college. And they are so dependent, especially now, on having jobs that can at least support that. We hear from so many of our own members as well as our community allies that people are very concerned that their children will not have the same kind of life that they currently have, though they're struggling. Their children won't have it as good as they have it because they see children returning back home. They're not able to pay for education because of this economic crisis that we're in. So the issue of education for so many parents and young people is critical. It certainly needs to be affordable. But one of the things that you look at, and when you say an election can make a difference, we've got to make sure that we have elected officials who are supportive of legislation, such as this administration was and this Congress was, in pushing forth Pell Grants for students. So under good administrations who really put their money behind educational policies to ensure that every child in this country who wants to have an education should have access to it, K through 12 and beyond, it's important that you're voting for those people who support those kinds of values.
And talk about the teachers for a minute. Everyone knows that without the teachers, the educational process simply won't happen. We need good quality teachers in the classroom. And if you can, tell us a little bit about how important it is to recruit and retain the best teachers.
Well, absolutely. You hit it, Jason, when you said good quality teachers. First of all, let me say that there are certainly tremendously, overwhelmingly, the majority of our teachers are good teachers. There is no doubt about that. We all often say it comes to our own minds when we think about our education, and especially through the K through 12 education, the teacher that helped us along the way. But teachers cannot do it alone. It takes a village, and you must have administrators, parents, teachers, and the broader community invested here. When we talk about the training of teachers, you've got to make sure that there are resources available for those who are in the system to be able to continue to be trained so that they kind of have the skills to keep up what's happening in society and be able to have knowledge of the curriculum that is always sometimes changing because our society is changing. But one of the ways in which you can certainly ensure that we can attract more quality educators, if you will, is we've got to make sure that teachers are paid properly. Here it is. Teachers are charged with educating our society, but yet many of them are not compensated adequately for what they do. I'd love to see them make the salaries of CEOs, quite frankly, but they may not get to that level. But one thing we know, that without teachers, again, having the ability to bargain collectively for good wages and working conditions, there would be no hope of their wages increasing. So teachers, certainly we need to find a way to pay our teachers their worth, and that would certainly bring more people into the education system, because many young people graduating from college would love to be teachers. But quite frankly, even if they come into the system for a few years, they often find that they cannot support their families on those wages, and then they may look to get out of the system. So increasing pay is vitally important. Making sure that there are adequate training programs there is important, and making sure, again, that we are not seeing so many of our children, you know, classroom size. We've got to have a reduction in the classroom size so the teachers can do what they're meant to do and give the kind of attention that they need to the students. But we all know that our classroom sizes are growing as opposed to decreasing.
And education has been at the forefront recently. You see it in the headlines and on the television and the radio. Everyone's talking about it. Do you think that we're on the cusp of a major education reform in this country to really get us where we need to be?
Well, I think there certainly is an awful lot of attention on education currently. In many ways, I think this is a unique opportunity. Our teachers' unions have made it very clear that they are willing to come to the table to find a solution because they want it to work too. They're invested in this. But I must say that there is great concern by many of us in terms of what's happening now, the bashing publicly of teachers and their unions. Again, teachers' unions are there to ensure that there is due process for those workers. So you never back away from that. But you certainly have heard President from the teachers' union, Randy Weingarten, say this is a time because the one thing that is clear, that teachers care about the future of this country, and that they know that the future of this country is only going to be brighter if we have more educated students. So they are focused on educating these students, but they also need some tools here.
Let's shift gears for just a minute and talk about job creation in America. Where do you think we are with that? Have we made enough progress? Are we doing the things that we need to do in order to really get people back to work and get the economy really going again?
Well, we certainly have made some progress. We must give credit to the Obama administration because the stimulus package, if we had not had it after he came into office, if we had not had that, we would not have been able to see at least 3 million jobs either created or saved. So that was absolutely necessary. But there is much more that we need to do. We need to put America back to work. One of the ways that we certainly believe that we could start to do that is we've got to invest in our infrastructure. We have a crumbling infrastructure. All of us know it. Our bridges are crumbling. Our roads are in need of great repair. We would have an opportunity, if we chose to do it, to invest in transportation and high-speed rail with good jobs, good-paying jobs, but also jobs that could be green jobs because of our concern for the environment. So recently, we certainly have heard the president talk about $50 billion that he'd like to have support for to put into infrastructure building. We certainly support that, because that could create jobs that just wouldn't impact construction workers or electrical workers, but it would have an impact on the whole of us. Because if we start to build our schools, build schools or build new schools or get that infrastructure, that's going to help with the education of the kids, the environment that they're in, right? A good building that is wired so that they can have the internet, that has an effect. When people go back to work, that means that they become taxpayers again. And this will help with the deficit that we see in so many of our governments locally, be it state, county, or city. So we'll help with the tax base there. When we put Americans back to work, we certainly see that it helps the whole of the community. One of the things, however, we would certainly, and we have been supporting here at the Federation and calling upon our government to do, is we believe strongly that we must support our small businesses because they can employ workers, but many small businesses say that they can't get right now the loans that they need to maintain their businesses. So we would like to see some of that leftover TARP money, about $30 billion of it, be invested with small community banks so that the community banks can start to lend again and lend to small businesses who do employ a lot of our workers.
And finally, we're starting to see now the implementation of the health care bill. Tell me your initial thoughts on that, how you think it's going, and maybe some thoughts for the future.
Well, my first thought is, you know, you can't get everything that you want, but for nearly 100 years in this country, we talked about the need for having health care reform and passing it. It was historic, the fact that we were able to get health care reform. We can always continue to try to build upon it, but certainly the foundation that we have is a good foundation. For example, I think this week as we're speaking, we will start to see the ability for us to keep our children, if we have children that are to the age of 26 years old, can be on the plan. This is a good thing. The money that will go out to our senior citizens, I think an average of about $250 to help them with prescription drugs, will be very helpful to us. It's a very good foundation to build upon. We in the labor movement, we know clearly that so often we have not been able to see wage increases for our workers, although production has been up in this country for workers. But because we were bargaining to make sure that our workforce had health care. Unions have bargained to ensure health care, therefore, in some instances, not being able to get the kind of wage increases that were necessary, but we've ensured health care. So this is good. Many of us certainly would have wanted maybe a public option. But you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, and you build on its foundation. So great first step, great historic step, and let's continue to see how we can make sure that it meets its guarantee that every person in this country, citizen in this country, has access to quality and affordable health care. That's the goal.
We'll certainly be keeping our eye on that in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Arlene Holt-Baker, Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, always a pleasure to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Jason, and we'll continue to fight for jobs. We certainly will continue to always fight for justice and for quality public education for all of our children.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little about the Office of Personnel Management's recently released the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, and premiums are going to be increasing by 7.2% in 2011. Is that right?
Well, every year when OPM announces the beginning of open season in the fall, they also at the same time publish the new premiums for the plans that participate in FEHBP. And so the headline is always the gross average, which doesn't really tell you very much about the range of premium increases that that there are within the program. You know, almost 30% of enrollees are going to have premium increases that are, you know, 10% or above. Some are even more than 50%.
Some people are going to have a 50% premium increase?
Some of the plans have a 50% premium increase. Yep, that happens every year. The most popular plan, however, the one that has the largest number of enrollees, is the Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. Every year, that's somewhere around 60% of all enrollees are in that one. And for that one this year, the enrollee share, the employee share, will be going up by 6.9% for those with self-only coverage and 7.6% for those with family coverage.
And how does this compare to previous years?
Well, if you're really looking for a silver lining and something positive to say, which, you know, takes some looking when it comes to FEHBP, we can say this. For the last 12 years, every year, the enrollees' share of premiums has gone up by more than the government's share, a higher percentage increase. That's been, you know, it's been a story of cost shifting, gradual cost shifting over the decade. And, you know, 12 years ago, it was about 72% the government's share, and now it's down to 67%. So if you're looking for good news, and as a comparison with previous years, you can say that this year, for the first time in a long, long time, there wasn't any additional cost shifting in Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. last year the government paid 67% of the increase. This year the government's paying 67% of the increase. And, you know, if you just do the arithmetic, then you know that this year for the first time the enrollee share didn't go up by any more than the government's share.
But when you compare that, as we look to what the impact will really be on federal employees with whatever the pay raise is going to be, does it essentially become a wash?
Well, we don't know the size of the pay raise yet. So, of course, it would only be a wash for some people depending on, you know, what your salary is. You know, no matter what your salary is, you pay the same premiums. They don't charge more for a GS-15 than they do for a GS-1. But, you know, the enrollee contributions are going to go up by about $300 a year for family coverage on average. And, you know, there's still the average family premium is you know, for an enrollee is around $4,500 a year. You know, that's a big bite out of anybody's salary. Obviously, a much bigger bite out of the lower graded employee's salary than the higher graded employee's salary.
And do we know anything? Do we know anything
about?
Do we know anything about the copays? Are copays going to be going up at all? Particularly, I'm thinking the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan.
No, that happened a few years ago. They changed the formula or changed the terms of enrollee copays for out-of-network and increased those dramatically. I mean, after we raised a lot of we were very, very strongly opposed to that, and we got the Congress to intervene and limit the amount of the increase of employee copays for out-of-network treatment in Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. They didn't go back to what it had been before. That was maybe 3 years ago. What I wanted to tell you, Ward, that, you know, it just sort of explains why FEHBP is so expensive and why we're such harsh critics of the program. And this has to do with, you know, what's going to happen next year, why these year-to-year costs are so outrageous and why some plans go up as much as 50%. This year, OPM, you know, puts out, like it does every year, puts out a call letter to the insurance companies telling them what they want to see in the coming year. So this year they put out, you know, this language, and they're always very, very sweet to their insurance companies. And they said that they'd like to see, not what we are requiring, but we'd like to see more benefits on testing donors for bone marrow or stem cell transplants. You know, these are rare situations for any enrollee, but when it occurs, when you are sick enough to need a bone marrow transplant or a stem cell transplant, you really need it. And so OPM was encouraging ever so gently the insurance companies to offer those kinds of benefits. Well, 16 plans have offered coverage for the testing of up to 4 transplant donors. So what's going to happen? Well, if you happen to be somebody who's going to need that kind of treatment, if you've got an illness that that kind of treatment is, you know, one of the possibilities in the course of your care, well, of course you're going to switch out of whatever plan you're in, and you're going to go into the plan that has this transplant donor coverage. And then what's going to happen to prices in those particular plans? They're going to go through the roof because all the sickest people are going to congregate in those plans. This is a long way of saying that FEHBP is a structurally flawed program, and it's why it's so expensive, because instead of having a standard benefits package and making all the different plans offer the same package and then compete on quality, they let them vary dramatically. And so people who are very, very sick congregate in one plan, and that one gets ridiculously expensive. And then it drives out all the, you know, healthier, lower risk people out of that plan into another plan, and you've got all kinds of skews in these prices. And instead of putting everybody in the same boat and then being able to negotiate for the best prices for everybody.
Well, let's also talk about the Affordable Care Act. Tell us a little about that. How does that affect federal workers and AFG members?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, which is the name of the act that we sometimes refer to as national health care reform, its provisions are being adopted, you know, gradually over the course of the next few years. And this year, there are two things that are you know, required by the law that FEHBP has adopted. And one is a really, you know, popular one and well-known one, and that is offering coverage for dependents up to age 26. And they don't have to be full-time students. So everyone has been, you know, everyone with an uninsured 23-year-old or 24-year-old has been very much looking forward to being able to have this. And you know, you have to have family coverage for eligibility on this. And so, you know, that's something from the Affordable Care Act that's certainly a positive. And the other new provision that is going to show up in FEHBP is that there'll be no more co-pays for preventive care and annual screenings. So those are two big positives. There's one other thing that's not the Affordable Care Act, and but they are also requiring this year all the plans to provide coverage for smoking cessation. And this includes, you know, medications and counseling sessions, up to 2 quit attempts per year, and all the plans will have that, and there will be no co-pays.
So for some folks, particularly people with children, say, under the age of 27, there may be some advantages to this new plan, obviously.
Oh, for coverage up to 26?
Yeah.
Oh, no question about it. It's extremely valuable and popular, and it's one of the most you know, the most popular parts of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, it went into effect September 23rd, but it couldn't go into effect for FEHBP because they gave plans an opportunity to, you know, wait to implement it until a new contract year following September 23rd. So January 1st, that's the date of coverage.
Are there any other things that AFG has been pushing, particularly in seeking to get in there that we've gotten?
That we have gotten?
Yeah.
No. I wish I were able to tell you that OPM had listened to our very persuasive arguments. We have been trying for years now, really getting close to 10 years, to get FEHBP to cover one particular treatment for autism. It's called applied behavioral analysis, and it's been found to be the most effective treatment for severely autistic children and needs to occur early in their lives to have its maximum impact. And, you know, once upon a time it was cutting edge, it was experimental, but that's no longer the case. It's certainly many, many large private employers cover it. And FEHBP, you know, has been a late adopter, and that's an optimistic way of saying it. They have failed yet again to ask the insurance carriers to cover that. So we'll keep up that fight. You know, it's not the kind of thing that's in any way frivolous. When you need this, you need this, and it's a glaring problem with coverage in FEHBP.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by Chris Garlock, the director of the D.C. Labor Film Fest. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Good to be back, guys.
So it's that time of year, the 10th annual D.C. Labor Film Fest, set for October 15th through the 19th. Tell us a little more about the event.
Well, first of all, we are incredibly pleased and frankly, a little bit surprised at, you know, we've made it to 10 years. It seems like it was just yesterday since we started the Labor Film Festival, but here we are, 10th annual. We will be up at the AFI in Silver Spring again. I think our biggest get, if you will, and the one I think of most interest to your folks, is our screening of a film called Fair Game, which it's a big Hollywood film. It's coming out, and it... it's about the Valerie Plame Joe Wilson situation. You may remember a little bit about that. And it's interesting because folks say, well, you know, sounds like a great film, and it's all about what happened when you know, Joe Wilson, did the op-ed, and then high-level Bush administration officials decided that the way to get him was to go after Valerie Plame, his wife, of course, who was a CIA operative. And so the connection for us is twofold. First of all, Joe Wilson was a whistleblower, and he blew the whistle on what was really going on with the Bush administration setting up this, you know, phony reason to start a war. But then Valerie Wilson, by getting caught up in this, I mean, she was, you know, a very good worker, and lost her job and her career for that matter, because of her husband being a whistleblower. So this obviously, is an issue across the country, but particularly here in DC with all of our federal workers who really, you know, need and deserve whistleblower protections.
And of course, there's legislation dealing with whistleblower rights that is up in front of the Congress now. And you've been dealing with this issue for a couple of years. Last year, you did a whole series on this. Give us a little history on this. How did this become a hot topic for the Labor Film Fest?
Well, you're right. It's the second year we're doing the Whistleblower series. It's basically a part of the Labor Film Festival. And what happened was that the Project on Government Oversight, POGO, which I'm sure you're familiar with, I know works with AFGE and a bunch of folks, came to us. They'd been wanting to do a film series about the whistleblowing issue for a number of years, and knew that, you know, we were doing the Labor Film Festival. And, you know, obviously right away we realized this is a worker issue, very clearly a worker issue of huge importance. And it was a natural for us, frankly. And so we pulled it together last year fairly quickly. It was the first time that we'd done it. We did a bunch of screenings up at Capitol Hill, very well attended, including a standing room only screening of the Dan Ellsberg film with Ellsberg. In fact, we had to use both theaters there at the Capitol Visitor Center. It was pretty amazing. And it was very popular. I mean, frankly, we knew the issue was important, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's going to translate into people coming out to films. And so we were really very pleased when so many folks, you know, proved that they cared about this issue by coming out to the films, staying afterwards, great discussions, really just a lot of engagement around this issue. And I think particularly showing the films at the Capitol Visitor Center, you know, they're in the U.S. Capitol. I mean, that's where these decisions are made. really kind of brought an immediacy to it that was really pretty special. So we're very happy to have that series back this year. And Fair Game is going to be our series closer on the 19th of October. And we're going to have Valerie Plame's going to be there, Joe Wilson's going to be there, director Joe Lyman's going to be there. It's going to be a whole red carpet event. And I've seen the film. It's a terrific film. I have to say, I'm really looking forward to seeing it again, because you watch that film, you've got a lot of questions you want to ask these guys. And so I'm looking forward to having them there so I can ask them the questions. And I think a lot of other people are going to feel that way, too. That's one of the great things about our film festival. We show great films, but we also bring folks to talk about the films. And that makes it a little bit of a different experience.
And in this day and age where you can go on websites and watch movies, you can download things, you can obviously purchase stuff online. I mean, what sets us apart is not just the selection of the films, some of which may be hard to find, some of which may not be. But as you mentioned, bringing in people to talk about each of the films, is that something that happens with each film that you select?
You know, not necessarily. We always have somebody to introduce the film and sort of put it in context. But it's also beyond when we do have folks to come and talk about the films. The other thing that's special, and you're absolutely right. I mean, these days, I mean, you know, my son watches movies on his iPhone. So, I mean, you know, it's that movies have not become, you know, when I was coming up, you went to the theater, it was a whole thing that really has changed. But I think the communal experience is still really, really critical. And one of the things that people just come up to me again, a lot of times, you know, we're going to show a great film, Outsource, possibly the only romantic comedy on the subject of outsourcing. People may have seen the NBC series. It's quite entertaining. I would go back and see the original film. I recommend it. It's a really lovely film. I remember when people came out of that screen when we first showed it a couple of years ago, it was, you know, kind of a date night. I think we showed it on a Friday night. But they came out and it really, especially like comedy, you know, when you're laughing, you know, I'm for laughing any time, but what you really want to be with other folks, you know, when you're doing that and be around other people, they stop at the cafe afterwards, have a conversation. So I think that there really is still value even in this, you know, multi-platform age to that communal experience.
Now, you know, the TV series you mentioned with Outsource is on, but a lot of folks probably, and myself included, didn't know there was an actual movie that this came out of.
Right.
Do you find, and there seems to be a theme there with, you know, The Office on TV, right. Outsourced. Do you think this is starting to become something that people are looking at, what's going on at the worksite?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I get excited. We have talked about it. This is our 10th year. The first couple of years, you know, I think everybody expected us to show, you know, Norma Rae, Mate One. I mean, all the wonderful Salt of the Earth. And we've done that. Those are great films. I'm sure we'll show them again. But one of the things that from the very beginning, we said, we want to find films that, like you're saying, maybe you never even heard of or you heard of, but you couldn't find them anywhere. And so, from the very beginning, that's what we've done. So yes, you know, we will show Office Space, for example, perennial. People love it. We, you know, raffle off the red stapler. It's a terrific film. But in the last couple of years, really even just predating the crash and the whole crisis, a lot of filmmakers were really starting to look more at what's going on with workers, you know, not just here in the United States, but around the world. And so, you know, that, you know, Fair Game, the Valerie Plame story, you know, that is interesting. You know, it's a dramatic story and you see this. I mean, it's a drama, by the way. It's not a documentary. I have to tell you that when you watch it, you come out and you're thinking, you know, it's very factual. I mean, but you really, it's incredibly dramatic. And that's what's very exciting to me is I love documentaries, watch them all the time. But I love a good drama that, you know, is thrilling and exciting. That's also based on something that's really happening to real folks. That's exciting.
And the tie there in some ways, I mean, when you mention like a movie like Norma Rae, and people think of that as an obvious labor film, but when we're talking about things today, because people say, well, you know, unions might have been significant, you know, years ago, or there might have been a reason for them. As you look at how the worksite is even today, and you look at, you know, what's going on when you outsource to India, you know, a call center, I mean, the working conditions there, the sort of sweatshop kind of mentality, how things are managed, and also to make it real for people in this country, you know, what really does go on over there. Do you think that does kind of update labor in a way?
I think so. And I think that, you know, whatever happens with the economy, you know, people are still working. There are still workplaces. And these are issues that are constant. You know, this is a film festival that, you know, will be around forever. And one of the exciting things is that more folks around the world are organizing labor film festivals because there are more and more films that are, you know, like you say, it's not just documentaries, but it's dramas, romantic comedies, or it's a science fiction film about working conditions. So, you know, we're all dealing, you know, with jobs in one way or another. And so it's sort of a natural thing. And I think sometimes it's like the air, you know, there's a lot of films that have work in them. And so I think that that's something, you know, so I think sometimes what happens is people think, well, you know, I'm working all day. I don't really want to go watch a movie about work. And it's one of the reasons why we try, frankly, to show fewer documentaries and more things that are, you know, entertaining first and happen to be about workplace issues second.
And you mentioned Office Space. Now that, I guess, is probably one of the most popular films you show. What do you think is responsible for that?
Well, it's funny as heck. You know, I watch it every year and, you know, I always think, I'll skip out. I'll go grab a beer at the cafe while everybody's watching. And I just can't tear myself away. That movie just holds up. you know, the Cube Farm is still there, you know, and it just, you know, last year was the 10th anniversary. We had the guys, you know, here, and we'll bring them back 4 years from now on the 15th anniversary. And, you know, it's just a funny movie, and it's, you know, it, a lot of humor is often based on things that, I mean, with The Office, the TV show, is cringing. Sometimes I watch it, I just can't bear to look, but you can't look away, right? I mean, these are, you know, we all work in offices. We know this stuff is true.
And are you finding that the people that attend these, are you seeing the same faces? Do you see new faces? Do different films get different kinds of folks?
Different films get different kinds of folks. I love looking around at the Labor Film Festival, and I see a lot of folks that I know, people I've walked picket lines with, people I work with at rallies and so forth here in the labor movement. And you know, we expect to see a lot more of those folks. But, you know, it's really exciting to me when I look around and I'm like, I don't know folks. And it's they're all kinds of people. They come for the movie first. And then they kind of, they come up afterwards and they start talking to us about unions. What is a union? How do you get involved? And, you know, that's a lot of the reason that we do the Labor Film Festival.
And as we come into our last minute or so in this segment, let's talk a little about the expansion. It's been around 10 years, but I know last year you were looking at expanding it. You went to Dublin, I guess it was.
Yeah.
So we're moving all around the world with this?
It's definitely expanding around the world. I'm talking to folks in several different places right now about starting things up in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. And we've been able to provide support for folks. But I actually, when we come back, I'd like to talk about the expansion right here in D.C. with our free Noontime series.
And we're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Chris Garlock, the director of the D.C. Labor Film Fest. So we're talking about some of the movies that are coming up for the film festival, October 15th to the 19th at the AFI in Silver Spring. And one of the ones we were talking about in terms of the dealing with whistleblowers would be The Informant. Tell us a little about that movie.
Well, it's another one, you know, I love all the films in the film festival. Everybody should come to every single film, but, The Informant is a Steven Soderbergh film, and anything Soderbergh does is always worth taking a look at. He's one of the most inventive and creative directors around. And when I heard he was taking on this issue of the ADM, price fixing issue, I thought, you know, I mean, how do you make a movie about price fixing, right? I just thought this is going to be crazy. And, you know, I went, but I knew it was about a whistleblower. So I thought this would be a good one for the whistleblower series. And I went and I looked and I watched it. And, you know, it's another one of these films that is just, you know, it's absolutely a brilliant, brilliant film. And, you know, it stars Matt Damon in, you just got to see this to believe it. I mean, it is one of his most interesting, bizarre roles that keeps you guessing literally until the last frame. And there's not a lot of movies that, I mean, you will not be sitting back in this film. I mean, I think a lot of people kind of missed it because they couldn't figure out whether to market it as a comedy or a drama or, you know, what it was, you know, and it's both. It's incredibly dramatic. I think it's funny as heck. I mean, I laugh, but it's a, you know, it's pretty fascinating film, and it really shows, you know, what happens when, you know, you do decide to blow the whistle, and what happens to whistleblowers. And in the whistleblower community, there's a lot of debate about Mark Whitaker's role, you know. I mean, you know, was he a whistleblower? Was he just crazy? I mean, maybe a little bit of both, right? I mean, you know, it's a tough issue. But I think that Soderbergh and Damon do a brilliant job of really exploring what happens when you get caught up. You know, I mean, bottom line, what was happening was absolutely wrong. And Whitaker, for whatever reason, was responsible for bringing that issue out. But you don't have to be interested in the issue to go see this movie. You just, you know, if you want to see a good movie, just go check out The Informant.
And that really does raise an issue. A lot of these movies about whistleblowing, you deal with the individual and the individual's personal story. And you can't help but become a complex figure, because when you're actually saying at some point, hey, I see some wrong and I'm going to write it, you know you're going to be upsetting some apple carts. You may be cutting your career short on some level. You may be starting, obviously, a very different career in some ways.
That's right.
And obviously, Valerie Wilson, you know, has a very different career mm-hmm. now than she once had. And are you finding, you mentioned last year you had Daniel Ellsberg come and talk about, you know, his situation. Do you find that the audiences are also very interested, not just in the movie, but I guess that part of it, and we mentioned the last segment really sets it apart. Do you find you really come away with something meeting some of these folks?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I love about the Labor Film Festival is that it really does. So many people, you know, so many workers are real heroes, you know in your own work, and I know in my work, you know, working in the labor movement, that we know that. And when you have films like the film about Ellsberg last year, like The Informant, like Fair Game, where you get to really know, you know, what's, and it is complex. It's not simple. I mean, a lot of these films are not, you know, somebody's just a pure 100% hero. These are complex characters because they're complex issues. But ultimately, they are still heroic in a very good sense. And I think that particularly here in Washington, where so many folks, you know, are working for the government and, you know, I think jobs where it can be very difficult, particularly depending on the political situations. And, you know, when these films come out and, you know, put up there on a silver screen, these characters, I find it very encouraging, and we look for those kinds of films. I'm looking for films that we can say, you know, yes, you know, these are folks that, you know, maybe they're flawed and they're not perfect, but, you know, this is a little piece of what it really is to be a worker in this country these days.
And in these two situations, of course, you're talking about federal employees.
Yes, you are.
Which in this DC area, and with AFG being federal employees, certainly is a good market for us on that issue. And as you look through the movies that are out there, I mean, let's go behind the scenes with you for a minute. What are some of the movies that you've really enjoyed and maybe didn't make the cut? And what goes through your mind in terms of making the cut?
You know, I always saw that, you know, I watch a lot of bad movies so that you don't have to. So, you know, we watch probably 300-400 movies over the course of the year to winnow it down to something, you know, that'll fit in the film festival. There are always a few that, you know, we wish we could get in and that somehow just couldn't, you know, in terms of we couldn't get the film or whatever. But, you know, first and foremost, when we're looking at the film festival, it's got to be entertaining. There's a lot of films that are, you know, good issues, well-intentioned, and probably we'll wind up showing them in another venue. But for the film festival, if you're going to come out and plunk down your money and spend your Friday or Saturday evening with us, you know, maybe with your family, you know, if you come out and you say to me, geez, that guy was, you know, I didn't like that guy in the movie, or I didn't like what he did, or, you know, I'm okay with that. But if you come out and you say that was a waste of my time, I got a problem, you know. So, you know, the movies that you're going to see in the Labor Film Festival are, number one, they're entertaining. And number two, there are things that you are going to come out, you know, you're going to be thinking about, you know, some issues. You know, and so that those are the two things that we look for. Number one, entertaining, and number two, that have some issues that have to do with work and workers. And that's, you know, it's harder to actually do than you might think. A lot of times people are like, oh, it must be so much fun. I'm like, you have no idea what I go through.
I'm sure some listeners are going to be sitting back going, yes, he has to watch movies for a living. It must be rough.
It is very tough sometimes.
But as you mentioned, other venues, that leads us in a good direction. AFG, amongst many other unions, are going to be doing some other venue movies situations for you. Explain what that is and how that's going to work.
Yeah, we're very happy about that. This is maybe the third or fourth year that we've done this. We started this because a lot of folks wanted to show films. DC's full of international unions, many of them supporters of the film festival. And so we wanted to think about what's a way that we can bring the movies to the people, basically, because, you know, we're a people's film festival. So we came up with doing this noontime series. We used to show films that would run 30 or 60 minutes. And frankly, it's difficult to find a lot of films that work. And an hour turns out to be a little bit long for lunch. So starting last year, we came up with this new thing that has been incredibly popular. We call it Working Lunch. And they are short films. I think this year's compilation, the shortest one's a minute. The longest one is 7 minutes. And it runs 30 minutes altogether. And a lot of them are funny. There's some musical ones. There's some very serious ones. There's one that talks about, it's a brilliant one that the IBEW put together, actually. It's very dramatic, and it shows what happens when people do basically a captive audience meeting, and it really gives you a feeling of what that can be like. It's a little dramatized, but I think gets the point across. But what's great about this is that, you know, so you can do it for a lunchtime screening. As you mentioned, AFGI's going to be doing one, and you can do it in a conference room. People can bring their lunch. I think IBEW for their screening is running at the popcorn machine. The great thing is that, you know, if you don't like this movie, it's only a minute long. Just hang in there. There'll be another one coming along in a couple of minutes. So it's been very, very popular. And we have, I think, a whole week. I think there's going to be 10, 12 screenings. Most of those are really just for, you know, local audiences. But some of the internationals are opening, like AFL-CIO will be open to everybody. So there, it's a neat thing. And anybody that's interested in hosting a screening will probably make that DVD available after the film festival as well. So the folks can do that sort of outside the film fest proper.
It sounds like you can move in a lot of interesting ways, because with YouTube and everything, and everybody with a flip camera essentially can make their own, you know, quick short movie. And I'm thinking, as you piece together some of those things, that could be some interesting things down the road.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, which is that we did a sort of a preview screening with one of our sponsors recently, and they're very interested in sponsoring a contest with us for just those kinds of films, and we think that's a terrific idea. We did one with Labor Star earlier this year. It was very popular. We got hundreds of entries. We made one mistake, which we said that the films could be up to 10 minutes long, which turns out to be way too long. So we're going to do it again with some other sponsors, and it's going to be, I think, 2 minutes. So I think we'll get some really, it'll be a lot easier on the judges.
Now, of course, this is not your only job. As much as you may want to just watch movies all day, every day, you also do something for the DC AFL-CIO, the Union City Newsletter. Tell us a little about how the newsletter works and how long you've been doing it.
Well, first of all, it's free to everybody. You can get it at www.dclabor.org. You can sign up free. It's award-winning. We just placed first again this year. It's the third year that we've won a prize as the best electronic newsletter in the ILCA competition. Second time we've won the top prize, so we're very proud of that. And we're one of the few, if not only, daily labor email publications in the country. And we basically cover the DC labor scene like a blanket. You know, if it's happening and it's of interest to the labor movement in DC, you're going to read about it in Union City. So, you know, rallies, organizing, the whistleblower issue. We work very closely with the internationals in town, all our local unions. You know, the council, of course, has almost 200 affiliates. So, and it's a very quick read. You know, you can just skim through the whole thing in about a minute, minute and a half. You can see I'm into the whole 2 minute thing. It's, you know, 2 minutes for your movies, 2 minutes for Union City. But, you know, people don't have a lot of time. Comes out every morning, 6 o'clock, and a lot of people tell me they read it in the metro on the way in. But that way, you know what's going on, what's the important rally that's coming up, what's in the news with the labor movement, and you can kind of have a good feel for that.
And I've always been amazed that it's actually very well read, and you've got a large readership. Tell us approximately how many folks do you pop it out to?
We're up to about 20,000 now. So, yeah, it just sort of keeps growing. And honestly, it must be passed around, because we've been so busy putting the darn thing out that we haven't really had time to do much promotion. So thanks for the shout-out as far as that goes.
And if listeners want to reach you online, is there any way to let you know about events or things, or kind of reach out?
Go to dclabor.org is probably the best way, and you can email me from there.
And as we go into our last 30 seconds, is there anything else the Washington Metro Council is working on? Obviously, the midterm elections, things that are planned.
D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, we're out there supporting all our labor-endorsed candidates. So get out there and vote on November 2nd.
I want to say thank you to our guests this week, AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker, AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon, and D.C. Labor Film Fest Director Chris Garlock. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from.